This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, homeless rest area Right to Dream 2 faces an eviction notice from the city.
The Clark Center, a homeless shelter in Portland, has been slated for closure due to budget cuts.
And Senator Rand Paul filibusters John Brennan's confirmation as CIA director.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 6, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Right to Dream 2, the homeless rest area on 4th and Burnside in downtown Portland, continues to fight the city to be able to continue providing services to people who are living on the streets in Portland. The city has levied tens of thousands of dollars of fines on the group, and the fines continue to increase every month. Mayor Charlie Hales told Street Roots newspaper in a recent interview that he will soon push the rest area to an alternate site somewhere other than downtown Portland. But it is in downtown Portland where most services for the homeless are located. A developer who owns the property across the street from Right to Dream 2 continues to pressure the city to evict the group, which has helped hundreds of people get back on their feet since it was established 18 months ago. The developer, David Gold, plans to turn the Old Grove Hotel into a youth hostel and says that the rest area would deter potential guests from visiting the hostel. To address this question, KBOO's Desiree Garcia spoke with guests and staff at Portland's two existing youth hostels on Northwest 18th and Southeast Hawthorne.
I would have no problem with that. Could be interesting to meet some homeless people. They have interesting stories to tell.
There can be like a homeless rest area like right there, like, and the city like on the other block can be like all this stuff. Like, it just doesn't matter.
It wouldn't bother you to stay there?
Yeah, it wouldn't.
Well, I've spent a lot of time in Portland over the years, and I feel comfortable in this city, and there's a large homeless population, and you just have to learn to live with that in Portland because most of them don't mean you any harm. So I'd be fine with it.
I think that Right to Dream should be looked at as any of the other establishments that are already in the downtown, which wouldn't be asked to move for a new establishment opening up. So I don't really agree with the fact that they want Right to Dream to move. I think that it's established there, and they should have the same right as any other business or organization to stay where they are.
So even as, like, say it was your hostel that was being opened up down there, would you mind being across an establishment like Right to Dream 2?
I think it would definitely be challenging because just the idea of hostels are looked at as a certain way, not always just for travelers, but more as, like, cheap places to stay. And, you know, there are certain policies against checking people in that are homeless, so it would be hard as the hostel owner to open up in the downtown. But, you know, any central city location is going to have its fair share of a homeless community, whether it's an organized place like Right to Dream. Or just, you know, being on the streets. And I think that's something that you have to understand if you're going to open a hostel in the downtown of a city. And it's such a positive or beneficial environment for the homeless community that I don't think they should be asked to leave.
Before I heard, like, he thought he wanted to move them. Like, I mean, that's fine to build there, but the fact that he won't build unless, like, the camp is moved, I think that's disgusting, honestly. Like, there's only so many places people can go. So.
Would you mind working at a hostel that would be right across the street from Right to Dream 2, like knowing
no,
what it is?
No, not at all. I mean, there might be safety issues, but I mean, I would work there if it was still there, obviously.
As she was interviewing guests and staff at Portland's two youth hostels, KBOO reporter Desiree Garcia discovered that one of the staff members at the Hawthorne Youth Hostel is a volunteer at Right to Dream 2, cooking burritos for the men, women, and children living on the streets in downtown Portland.
If you could tell me who you are and how you're connected to Right to Dream 2.
Joaquin Ortiz. I'm one of the creators of the Portland Burrito Project portion. And in terms of Right to Dream, I see them on a monthly basis. Primarily delivering food, but I've also been able to see the growth from when they first started, where it was just flat plow land, to where they are today, where it's actually really structured and organized.
So you've pretty much built connections with the people that live there and what's going on there and everything?
There's a few people that I know by name, and they recognize us pretty well. And I've also been at least seen some of the organization side where they have Sisters of the Road Kitchen, been a part of the meetings there, and kind of heard a right to dream of how they actually organize and what their goals are and who they're working with to get there. And so from the homeless perspective of, they're different in the sense of they have their own guidelines and criteria of how you enter that area. You have to be sober, you have to be in at this hour, and you have to be out at that hour. It's different than most homeless camps I think you'd find. For the hostel, I don't know too much about that, but that'd be a bummer if he actually tries to wipe them away.
Just from kind of like on the know of what's going on and everything, what do you think would be like a good solution as far as Right to Dream 2 and like this hostel and all that's like going on with that?
The hostel is traditionally just kind of have an open arms kind of feel, so I think there would be a good opportunity to at least have a working relationship, much like Sisters of the Road Cafe has, where you kind of work and earn your keep. If you want a meal or you need something from them, they have a beautiful relationship with people on the go or just in low-down situations for anyone. So I think that has good potential. On another level, though, I think what Right to Dream does have is a good example of what other cities can try to emulate in terms of, here's a space reserved for people, here's the organization structure or platform, and allow that own community to kind of build it and have that ownership. And that way, I mean, visually it's better for the city and it's better for just the whole community. Whether you're homeless or just someone on the street, I mean, you don't know that there's an area reserved that they can at least be better off than being on the streets in some sense.
That was KBOO's Desiree Garcia speaking with staff and guests at Portland's International Youth Hostels about the claim that they would not want to stay at a hostel constructed across from the Right to Dream 2 rest area downtown.
As the city of Portland decides on budget cuts to a number of programs, one of the biggest hits will be to transitional housing for homeless men. The Clark Center, which is run by Transition Projects and houses 90 men, will lose its entire budget and will close unless the mayor changes his mind about cutting the center's funding. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Doreen Binder, the executive director of Transition Projects.
Can you talk about some of the services that Transition Projects provides here in the Portland area?
We have what was formerly known as shelters. We now call them short-term facilities because there's so much more work and services that come out of there. We have Jean's Place, our women's facility, which is 60 women in Northeast Portland. And we have the new Bud Clark Commons and a facility, short-term facility there that's for 90 men. And then we have the Clark Center, which is in Southeast Portland on MLK and Hawthorne. And that was built in 1998 and has been operating for 90 men in a short-term facility for moving people off the streets and into permanent housing. And there's case management there. There's intervention programs for alcohol and drugs and mental health. There's life skills programs, multitude of programs at each site.
Portland City Council is discussing some pretty hefty budget cuts to our local city budget. How are those going to impact your work?
Our facilities are funded in part. About 50% of our budget comes from the City of Portland through the Portland Housing Bureau. And Clark Center receives about $500,000 a year, $530,000 a year to operate. 365 days a year, 24 hours a day for 90 men. We see about 650 men go through that facility each year, and about a third of them or more get into permanent housing through our facility. The city has some very difficult decisions to make, and what they decided for some reason, because our budget at the Clark Center is $500,000, that was a big piece that they could eliminate. The Bureau has to eliminate $2.5 million or $2.3 million. What that would mean, and what I'm trying to explain to the city and to everybody that will listen. This is really not a Transition Projects issue or a Clark Center issue. This is a public safety and a community issue. Yes, 15 people will lose their jobs, but 650 men will be on the streets throughout the year. Our wait list now for men to get into our facility is over 3 months. And there are, I think there's over 300 people on the wait list for the men's wait list and almost close to 200 women on our wait list to get in. And it's probably 12 to 15 weeks to get into our facility before you can get in. You're on the wait list that long. What it would mean if we close this, because then it's called Doreen's Place downstairs at the other facility, it would double. Because the wait list for men would go to probably 6 months. And so this is really counterproductive. You can cut services sometimes, and we can find funding for services through other means, but I don't think you cut a facility where people live and sleep. And so I think this is really, I believe very strongly, this is a mistake. And I'm hoping against all hope that Mayor Hale makes a decision that this should be kept open.
Wow. And what are you asking for people to do to support keeping the Clark Center open?
We're going to the budget hearing tonight, and we're having some of our graduates go. We're asking people to go to the budget hearings, to write to the mayor, to let people know how important this is. And you know, the police are not happy about this. The business associations are not happy about this because it's more people on the street.
I've been speaking with Doreen Binder, who is the Executive Director of Transition Projects. If you want to find out more about the campaign to save the Clark Center, the website again is savetheclarkcenter.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Police in Olympia, Washington have arrested 7 activists on state property for refusing to take down a homeless protest camp. The activist group, Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, began their protest on Friday by placing a large tent labeled Homeless Shelter at Olympia's Artesian Wells. On Monday, activists responded to the city manager's request to leave city property by moving the tent to property belonging to Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife. Yesterday, the State Department posted a cease and desist order, citing safety issues related to a nearby condemned warehouse. And later yesterday evening, police arrested 7 activists who refused to comply with the state's 6 p.m. deadline. The arrests occurred at the same time as a meeting on homeless issues held downtown between the Olympia City Council and the Thurston County Commission. So far, the City Council has earmarked $35,000 for homeless assistance, although the city has not reached any agreement with homeless advocacy groups on how to address the issue.
Group home workers at a local facility for the developmentally disabled rallied today as part of their union organizing effort. Bethesda Lutheran Communities is a chain with homes for the developmentally disabled throughout the Portland area and across the nation. Workers at the Southeast Portland Group Home are organizing a union for higher wages, better working conditions, and respect on the job. KBOO reporter Jamie Partridge spoke with Paul Dean, an employee who confronted management today, demanding recognition of their union, Service Employees Local 503. A crowd of 25 workers, community supporters, and faith leaders marched to Bethesda Lutheran corporate headquarters this morning. Father Jack Mossbrecher and Father Bob Kruger were rebuffed in their attempt to enter the building, forced to present their petition to a management representative through a partially opened door. Penny Ruff, an SEIU organizer, read the petition aloud as the workers vowed to continue their struggle for a voice at Bethesda Lutheran Group Homes.
I'm sitting here with Paul Dean. What's going on this morning, Paul?
We've come down here today to go into the Bethesda offices and tell them to talk to the union and not just come out with a lot of nonsense with their flyers and that and their intimidation tactics against people who are organizing.
Bethesda Lutheran is, you say, intimidating workers who are trying to organize a union. Now, you work at one of these group homes, is that what they are?
That's right. Bethesda's got a number of homes around Portland and indeed around the country. Each home has about 5 people in there, 5 residents in there, and there's a number of people who are working 24 hours a day to support these people. And it's kind of various degrees of disability that people have. So some are semi-independent and some are fully dependent. You know, they need their diapers changed and need help feeding, you know, all kinds of things like that. And that's what the workers do there.
You work the night shift?
Yeah, I've just come off the night shift. The reason Bethesda workers have come together is because of the low pay that we're getting. I mean, we're a little above minimum wage, you know, and so it starts off about $9.50 an hour, I think, and then goes up to $10. I think I've been working there 2 years and I get $10.40 an hour. But there's people who've been working there 13 years and they get $11.60 an hour or something like that. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. And there's you know, a lot of responsibility with the job. And we have to pass the medications. We have to take care of the people, you know, look out for the people's welfare. And you know, I mean, there's also cases where staff are being assaulted.
What are the main issues that you're bringing to the management?
Well, we're just telling them to be honest about what's going on. I mean, they've accused the union of being bullies and thugs. Now we've been going around intimidating workers at the various homes. And we're telling Bethesda that, you know, it's really time to talk fairly with the union.
Have they recognized the union?
No, they haven't. They've been very hostile right from the start. And the ridiculous thing is that Bethesda's meant to be a non-profit Christian organization, and yet the CEO makes some ridiculous salary. I think it's something like $400,000 a year, while the workers are a little above minimum wage.
So the workers want a union. The workers have signed cards saying that they want a union?
We've been going around getting cards signed and that. Because of the nature of the workplaces, it's very hard to get in contact with workers. That's where the intimidation from management comes in, because they just really scare people, you know, and they've just told a lot of nonsense, really, about what the union's going to do. You know, and all kinds of scared.
What do you expect to have happen today with the going to the management office?
They're going to talk fairly, the union, us have access to the workers without intimidation.
So what are some of the issues, besides low pay, that the workers are organizing around?
One of the things is no holiday pay. You know, for a Christian organization, they don't even give Christmas Day off as a paid holiday.
Is health insurance or health care an issue?
They do offer health insurance, but to be quite honest, it's so expensive. Coverage is not very good. When you're only getting $10.40 an hour, a lot of people just can't afford it.
This is Jamie Partridge with the KBOO News.
An Oregon City man is on trial for federal tax evasion and trying to obstruct Internal Revenue laws. Federal prosecutors allege that for over 12 years, Chester Evans Davis took extreme steps to avoid paying taxes, including sending fictitious documents to the IRS and attempting to file arrest warrants against IRS employees. Davis is the former owner of Electrical Systems Analysts Incorporated, a Gladstone-based company which sold engineering software to multiple federal government agencies. The prosecutor calls Davis's actions a double standard of taking money from federal agencies but refusing to pay his fair share of taxes. Davis submitted a declaration to the court in November saying that he does not recognize the court's authority. His attorney said that Davis refuses to assist with his own defense and directed the defense to not make any opening statements, to question witnesses, or to lodge objections or offer any closing argument. A link to Davis's declaration can be found on the KBOO News Twitter stream at KBOO News.
Portland City Council was presented with the audit of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for fiscal year 2011 to 2012 this morning. Two Portland residents were there to let the council members know what they would like to see in the future. Joe Walsh brought up Portland's D-minus grade for transparency.
When I went to college, if I got a D-minus, I'd be in a lot of trouble. I'm just asking you to raise that to a B or A minus. Not asking for perfection, but that's a little ridiculous to be that low in this kind of a city.
Mr. Walsh was referring to a recent report released by the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group Foundation that looks at the transparency in spending in America's 30 largest cities. Recommendations to improve Portland's transparency include providing an online database with, quote, checkbook-level detail, posting copies of contracts between vendors and the city online, and disclosing tax subsidies given to companies. Mary Eng says gender pay inequalities need to be included in the report in order to set a benchmark and start working to close the gap.
For me, I know this is a huge thing to ask of you guys, but in terms of the audit, one other thing that's strikingly missing, especially during Women's History Month, is a gender equity overhaul. Where do we have statistical analysis of the gender pay gap? And then we can set some milestones and markers for where we want to pull it.
A 2012 report from the National Women's Law Center found that Oregon's gender pay gap is equal to the national average of 77%. Oregon women with a bachelor's degree make 75 cents for every dollar paid to their male colleagues. The majority of the audit's results pertain to issues such as the city's compliance with state laws, financial reporting, and federal grant compliance.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Treasures from the KBOO Vault at 6. On tonight's episode, an interview by Margaret Bueller with two representatives of Voices of Hope and Anger, women who are fighting the presence of U.S. military bases at home and abroad. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a high temperature of 55 degrees.
It's 5:22 in the post-meridian. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Well now, here's some unexpected news. It comes from what purports to be an official document of the National Republican Party. And wow, the policy positions it contains show that the party leaders really are serious about coming to their senses and rejecting the plutocratic extremism and far-right wackiness that has stained their recent presidential, congressional, and gubernatorial campaigns. Right at the top, this 18-page manifesto proclaims that, quote, "Our government was created by the people for all the people, and it must serve no less a purpose. All the people." Forget last year's ridiculous pontifications by Mitt Romney and others, dividing America into virtuous creators, like themselves, and worthless moochers, like you and me. This document abounds with commitments to the common good. Quote, "America does not prosper," it proudly proclaims on page 3, "unless all Americans prosper." Shazam, that's downright democratic. And how's this for a complete turnaround? Labor is the United States. The men and women who, with their minds, their hearts, and hands, create the wealth that is shared in this country, they are America. Holy Koch brothers, share the wealth? Yes, and how about this? The protection of the right of workers to organize into unions and to bargain collectively is the firm and permanent policy of the Republican Party. Eat your heart out, Scott Walker and you other labor-bashing GOP governors. The document also supports the Postal Service, the United Nations, equal rights for women, expanding our national parks, vigorous enforcement of antitrust laws, and raising the minimum wage. New enlightenment in the grand old party. Hallelujah! This is Jim Hightower saying, can all this be true? Yes, except it's not new. This document is the Republican Party platform of 1956.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky began a rare speaking filibuster on the Senate floor this morning to try to stall the confirmation of CIA Director nominee John Brennan. Paul is questioning the administration's targeted assassination program, which John Brennan led as Homeland Security Advisor during Obama's first term. He also expressed anger over a letter issued this morning by Attorney General Eric Holder that allowed for the possibility of using drone strike assassinations against Americans on U.S. soil. For more, KBOO's Stephen Sherritt spoke with former CIA officer Colleen Rowley.
If you would mind elaborating on some of the constitutional issues that are coming into question in regard to the information released in this letter.
Constitutional issues all arise, or they're rooted in, the authority to use military force that passed 3 weeks after 9/11. The Congress people who voted for the AUMF back then believed that it was only to use military force in Afghanistan to go after the so-called Al-Qaeda terrorists. Now, what's happened is in these 11 years, it has broadened and been stretched immensely to now that the administration says any country, even including the United States, is the part of the global battlefield in the so-called war that has no end because it's on a tactic of terrorism. And so it's been broadened. It's now also broadened not to just be Al-Qaeda or Taliban. It includes affiliates. It can be new groups that are formed. There's all kinds of questions about this authority to use military force. And yet, there really has not been much of a debate. There has been almost no debate. And I think this moment now of questioning John Brennan's confirmation is furnishing that moment for a debate, and that's why Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, has seized on it, because he realizes if you lose this part and you're giving the president this much power, it's going to be very hard to ever retract that.
I was wondering if you could talk some more about your concerns in regard to John Brennan's nomination to be director of the CIA.
John Brennan's is a very key figure because he began at the start of the so-called War on Terror. And it's believed that he was an architect to some extent of the extraordinary rendition kidnappings under the Bush administration. His name appears on 50 different memos that were involved with the so-called waterboarding and torture, as well as these secret black sites. And so he was in the loop. Even before that, John Brennan was probably, although no one checked the memos, he was probably involved in concocting the intelligence that George Tenet was his direct boss. And George Tenet, of course, used this false intelligence to say that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and was connected to 9/11 and connected to terrorism. It was completely false. And Dianne Feinstein never even researched to find out what Brennan's connection was to the false concocting of info for war on Iraq. Then you get to these memos where his name's on these 50 memos about black sites and whatever, and very little questioning was done on that. Now there's even something worse because Brennan made a statement that he believed Iran has a weapon, a nuclear weapon program, and has intercontinental ballistic missile system to deliver nuclear weapons. And that statement that he made to the committee, of course, he thinks he's pandering to people who want war on Iran, but that statement contradicts the intelligence community. There are 16 agencies in the intelligence community, and they have found, actually, that Iran does not have a nuclear weaponization program. They're enriching uranium, but so far there's been no proof that they're doing so in order to create a nuclear bomb. And the other thing about intercontinental ballistic missile system is even more ridiculous.
Are there any ways that you've seen people organizing to address these issues?
Well, there's a couple of ways. I think the most effective organizing is not through political parties. And, of course, I've noticed when I was listening to Rand Paul, he was saying over and over, this has nothing to do with partisan politics. And so my suggestion for organizing is it should transcend political party loyalties. This should be an issue that is an issue of right and wrong that has nothing to do with the so-called right or left. Every American citizen has to do what they can. They have to make a noise, write letters to the editor. Every citizen has to get involved in these issues. You may not care that much about Constitution and law. Yes, you're going to have to pay attention and get involved right now because we are all we have.
That was former CIA officer Colleen Rowley speaking with KABU's Stephen Sherritt on the filibuster currently being carried out by Senator Rand Paul to try to block the nomination of John Brennan as CIA director.
A revised draft of the environmental impact statement for the Keystone XL pipeline was released Friday by the U.S. State Department. Private consultants with oil industry ties were largely responsible for preparing the report. In 2011, the State Department was criticized for hiring a consultant who had previously worked for TransCanada, the company building the pipeline. None of the current consultants have known ties to TransCanada, but several have previously worked for companies already developing Canadian oil sands. Three of the six consultants do not have websites accessible to the public and have not disclosed any of their previous clients. One of the main issues environmentalists have with the pipeline is their claim that with the completion of the pipeline, production would increase in the oil sands. The report claims that building the pipeline would not lead to an increase in production, that existing pipelines and railways would be used to export oil. David Dreisen is a law professor specializing in economics and environmental law. He says a lot of the projections of future production has to do with which facts are emphasized and how the information is gathered. The public has 45 days to submit comments on the latest draft. After that, the State Department will release the final environmental impact statement, a document that will influence President Obama's decision on the pipeline.
The European Union has fined Microsoft nearly $750 million for not offering users of its Windows operating system a choice of internet browsers. Microsoft promised to give users the option of not automatically installing Internet Explorer in a 2009 settlement with the European Union executive arm, also known as the Commission. The Commission admits it was naive to allow Microsoft to monitor itself for compliance with the agreement and won't allow that practice in the future. Microsoft admittedly broke its own promise for over a year when they automatically installed an estimated 15 million copies of Internet Explorer on users' computers without the option to refuse. This is the first time Microsoft has admitted to breaking a promise with EU regulators. They claim it was an oversight. Microsoft is required to continue to offer users a choice of browsers through 2014. To date, they have paid nearly $3 billion in fines to the European Union since the first antitrust investigations began in 1998.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.